My name is Kevin Morgan. I'm Professor of Governance at Cardiff University. This evening in Glasgow, I'll be talking about urban food policy. And basically, it means looking at the rise of the city as a new player in food policy debates. And I'll be looking at cities around the world, London, New York, Vancouver, Toronto, and trying to distill some lessons for cities here in the UK, particularly Glasgow. What I want to talk about for the next 30, 35 minutes or so, then leave plenty of time for discussion, I want to talk about the rise of cities as important players in the new debates around the world about food security, health and well-being. I think that the rise of the city is one of the most important changes that's been going on in the global north as well as the global south over the last 10 or 20 years or so. And what I propose to do is to try to explain why that's happening. I'm going to try to show some examples of leading cities around the world, what they're doing with, in, and through their food systems. And then I'm going to try to bring the story home to the United Kingdom to try to look at what it means for us in terms of how do we promote healthier cities through more sustainable food systems. But before I do that, can I just very, very briefly add a personal note about food. I never planned to do any work on food. It was never part of my research agenda. And I got into it 12 years ago by accident, because I got involved in a small project which we used to call in Cardiff a labour of love. That is to say, a research project that wasn't funded, and we did it because we thought it was intrinsically interesting and intrinsically important. But no funds were involved at all for 12 months. And it's difficult sometimes as an academic to justify what you're doing when you're not publishing, when you're not bringing in research income. And we worked on school food, where food came from that ended up on a child's plate, what we call the provenance of the public plate. Where did the food come from? And that simple project meant a great deal to me personally, because it spoke a lot about the way in which universities work today. Because the overwhelming reaction from the university was to find this a rather, not just a comical subject, school dinners. Are you really working on school dinners, colleagues would say, my head of school said. And colleagues either found it comical or they found it beneath the dignity of the academy. That was just 12 years ago. The thought that somebody could be working in a university on school dinners was either comical or risible. And I say this story because I tell my younger colleagues that they should have more confidence in working on topics, labours of love, if you will, of what is intrinsically important to them. And they should have more confidence in that, because our work only got validated. I'm mentioning this work because I moved from school food, from public food provisioning in schools, hospitals, care homes, prisons, the way in which food is provided for, in other words, in the public realm. I moved from that public plate focus to the role of cities. But our work in the university was only validated, only recognized, when we started to bring in first research income from research councils, then the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation began to fund our work with the World Food Programme, and then finally we were invited to the United Nations to present our findings. And I say that not to blow our trumpet, but to show how work that begins to be seen as comical ends up being validated only by research money and then by the recognition of the powers that be. So what's the moral of the story? Well, I guess it is to have some faith in your own decisions to work on things which are intrinsically important. And today I would say, bring it up to date, that the role of cities in food systems is now one of the most important topics in the debate on sustainability, and I'll try to justify that argument in the next 30 minutes or so. to leave plenty of time for discussion. So hopefully this is all going to work, David. Okay. So the overview, very simply, is how has food moved from the margins to the mainstream of our political agendas, particularly the urban political agenda, where still too many cities in Europe still don't understand, don't appreciate the full significance of food. Then I want to say, do a cook's tour, as it were, a quick tour around the world of what cities are doing in the global north and the global south. Then I want to bring it back home to look at the rise of the urban food movement in the United Kingdom, to look at what I call urban food politics, and then to end with these new forms of urban food governance that I think are very, very important, even though they're still slightly below the radar of mainstream politicians. Okay, so it's worth remembering that when food was still at a Cinderella status to it, it wasn't just seen as comical in the academy, in universities, it wasn't even on the radar of urban planners. It was called a forgotten or ignored or an invisible domain. Two American planners 10 years ago, Kami Pothakuchi and Jerry Kaufman, argued that the food system was a stranger in the planning system. Planners had addressed all the essentials of human life, air, water, land, shelter, and so forth, with the conspicuous exception of food. That's a long story why that was the case. We can discuss it later. But the fact is, it wasn't on the planning agenda. It's still not sufficiently on the planning agenda today, but we can't say it's a stranger anymore, because some leading cities are showing that the way to sustainability is partly through the food system. As a famous food campaigner in Toronto put it, the way to a city's heart is through its stomach. And I'll come back to that in a moment. So, what's changed to move food from the margins to the mainstream? There's no single reason. There's a whole bunch of reasons as to why food is now at the top of political agendas around the world. The American government now classifies food security as a national security issue. Why? Because during the food price spike of 2007-2008, which really heralded the end of what we call the era of cheap food, we're going to have to get used to higher prices for our food. Those higher prices triggered urban riots all over the world, not just in low-income countries, but in some middle-income countries as well. So much so that food security is now firmly on the agenda as a national security issue. The other drivers we're now familiar with, the way in which food is implicated in nearly a third of greenhouse gas emissions in the European Union. We all know that food is now at the heart of what the World Health Organization calls the double burden of malnutrition. Too often we think of malnutrition as just about hunger, but now it's about overweight and obesity as well, because both are forms of malnutrition, strictly speaking. Planners, enlightened planners, I should say, are beginning to accept and recognize the food system as a prism, a lens, through which they can address a whole bunch of other issues which they're more familiar with, to do with land, water, energy, and of course the services that Mother Nature gives us for free, what we now call ecosystem services in the jargon of today's planners. And because so many stories about food are about gloom and doom, climate change, obesity, hunger, so on and so forth, we sometimes forget that it's also about pure joy. To enjoy really good food with good friends and family is a congenial experience, or it ought to be, whether we're talking about school children or even in hospital settings. Patients ought to have access to good food that they can enjoy. And of course, rapid urbanization has put urban food security on the agenda like nothing else. So putting all these things together, this is why food has moved from the margins to the mainstream in our thinking around the world. There's no single reason. This is why, even though hunger, I think, trumps every other issue to do with food, because hunger has the greatest claims on our ethical sensibilities and trumps every other issue, in my view. Even as important as hunger is, it doesn't mean we can reduce food to a narrow nutritional issue. Food is about all these other things: health, culture, social justice. So we can't reduce it just to nutrition, even though nutrition is very, very important. Okay, so those are the drivers of change. These are the reasons why food is now from the margin to the mainstream of our societies. Let me now do a very, very quick cook's tour around the world, just to look at what some cities are doing with the food system, and then I'll bring the story back home to look at the issues facing us here at home. Food planning is now one of the fastest growing areas in the planning community around the world, particularly in the American Planning Association, which really got the message first. Sad to say, they were ahead of us in terms of European planners. There are now, actually my figures here are out of date, there's now 270 food policy councils. I'll come back to these new institutions in a moment. 270 food policy councils in North America. Most of those grassroots, civil society-based organizations. But although small, medium, and large cities can form food policy councils, it's the larger cities, by and large, which have hogged the headlines and dominate the headlines for obvious reasons, because they are iconic cities. We're all familiar with these cities. Let's look very, very briefly at each one. New York City, and I'll come back to New York City right at the end, because I don't know another city, either in Europe or in North America, which has taken its public health mandate more seriously than New York City to regulate the food system under its public health mandate. I'll come back to that in a moment, but just to suffice it to say for the moment, New York City has got a new plan for food now, which looks at the food system as a system, from farm to fork to post-consumption. It's thinking of food in systemic terms, not just in this or that project. And that's very, very important for us to get away from this era of what we might call projectitis, when small groups do a well-meaning, laudable project in this or that area of a poor neighborhood, and the project never outlasts the funding. We're all familiar with that dilemma. This is an attempt to get beyond projectitis and to think of the food system as a system. New York, I'll come back to it. Seattle is also one of the pioneers in thinking about urban food planning in North America. Notice it's not just addressing things like vending machines in schools, which are very important, by the way. It's also thinking about expanding community gardens, helping people to learn to reconnect to nature through growing, eating, cooking together. But notice also that Seattle also sees the food system and its urban food policy as a way of combating racism in the city as well. It's part of a progressive social policy to fight social injustice and racial injustice as well. This is the wider meaning of sustainability. San Francisco is doing the same with a fully integrated strategy which links the social, the economic, and the ecological. Toronto is probably the most famous food policy council in North America. In my view, the most innovative of the lot, because what Toronto shows us is that food can help every department of government. If we take a city council, for example, there's not a single portfolio in a city council, in a city government, which hasn't got a role to play in contributing to a sustainable food system. So the old debate about who's responsible for food policy in a city or in a government is very simple. Everybody has a role to play, and therefore we need to appreciate that food can help every department fulfill its obligations. Very, very quickly, I'll come back to Africa in a moment, but I just want to mention that urban planners throughout Africa have been part of the problem of hunger and not part of the solution. Why? Because urban food growers and urban food farmers, urban food vendors, 75%, by the way, are women, have been harassed by urban planners. They've been swept from the streets because they pose a threat to either traffic congestion or public health or whatever. Or else they've been seen as a sign of backwardness, that urban agriculture has no role to play in a modern thriving city. Whereas the irony is that the most sustainable cities in the global north are those that are reintroducing urban agriculture into their city fabrics, into their public spaces. And therefore, urban planners in many African cities have been part of the problem. Some of them, Kampala, in Dar es Salaam, are now beginning to get the message, and they're addressing the problems of urban food vending, access to clean water, access to safe places, access to land rights. This is the way to make urban agriculture benign and sustainable, socially just, and allowing gender to play a major role in development. So these are some of the reasons why urban planners now are becoming part of the solution to urban food security and not part of the problem. In Latin America, the Latin American debate is dominated by Belo Horizonte. Belo Horizonte is the city, quote, "the city that has abolished hunger," maybe a bit too extreme, as some people say, but a city that has gone further in addressing the problems of urban hunger than any other city in the world, to my knowledge. And it's now being recognized through the accolades and the awards it's winning. Belo Horizonte in Brazil, and Brazil itself has a strong federal system. So Belo is a strong city in a strong urban food security country. Coming to London, coming to the UK rather, and Europe, these are some of the cities that have pioneered sustainable urban food plans. Rome, which I'll come back to in a moment, London, when it was launched by Ken Livingstone in 2006, and Amsterdam. One of the things I think that all these cities have in common, while they played very, very important pioneering roles in developing urban food plans, all of them have regressed badly. Why? Because they couldn't sustain sustainability. And this is a great political challenge to all our organizations, whether we're talking about small municipalities or large cities or even the country. It's not enough to meet a standard. That standard, that plan has to be sustained. Because, for example, in Amsterdam, the food strategy was the plan of the deputy mayor. When she lost office, the food plan fell with her. In other words, she hadn't built the support in civil society for that food strategy. And this is an important lesson, I think, that we can all learn. We have to build the values of sustainability in our civil societies, because then politicians wouldn't dare to change the policy when they come in and out of office. We've got to embed sustainability if we want to sustain it. Currently, I'm doing a lot of work in smaller, what you might call non-global, ordinary cities. And if you'll bear with me for 5 minutes or so, I'd just like to do a quick tour of Malmo in Sweden. And I know Glasgow has very strong links with Gothenburg, for example, which we'll come back to in a moment. But we're working with Malmo and with Bristol. Let's look at what these cities are trying to do to address the issues that I've just been talking about. Malmö in southern Sweden, for those of you who follow Wallander and Nordic noir detective stories, you'll know that Malmö is one of the main cities in the region of Skåne, as the Swedes say, or Skåne, as we say, we Brits say. And it's a very, very important city in food policy terms because of it's doing something revolutionary, I think. So, first of all, what is the smart policy? Notice it doesn't fetishize local. Smart, smaller amounts of meat, minimizing junk food and increasing organic, right sort of meat and vegetables, seasonality is big, transport. Why I think Malmo is doing something truly radical in the world is because it aims to go 100% organic in all its school canteens and all its kindergartens by 2020, and to do so to do so in a cost-neutral way. I said to the director, I thought that was mission impossible, and I didn't believe he could do it, and I'd be back in 2020, hopefully, to see if they'd done it. But I was interested in how they thought they could do this in a cost-neutral way. And we can come back to this in discussion in a moment, but two of the ways in which they're doing it, and I know Robin Gurley is in the audience today, and I'll talk about him later, because he's been one of the urban food pioneers in Scotland, where I worked with him for many years on what he did in East Ayrshire in terms of revolutionising school catering in Scotland. But this is what they did in Malmo to try to revolutionise it. They work at both ends of the food chain to try to build a new business model of school food. So they start with waste, by minimising waste. If you minimise waste, all those savings that you secure through minimal waste, you plough back into the start of the food chain by allowing you to buy slightly more expensive ingredients. That's one way they're doing it. But the second way they're doing it is through radical menu redesign. They're dropping meat from some days. And when I said to them, well, this is obviously meat-free Mondays that we know about in the UK, they said, we don't frame our food in negative terms like that because we're not denying children something when we don't give them meat. We might be giving them a delicious vegetarian meal. It's not anti-meat, but it's less meat. That does two things. It takes costs down radically, and it also brings your carbon footprint of your food system down even more. So these are two of the ways in which Malmo is trying to reinvent a sustainable, cost-effective and affordable school meal system. So I brought this team over to Bristol to try to teach the Bristol catering people how to do it. And now they're forming a joint venture. Malmo is leading by example. This is one of my favorite slides from the Malmo system, because they're leading by example. They're not exhorting others to do something that they haven't done themselves. Their philosophy, the typical Swedish way of understatement, self-deprecating, they are putting their own house in order first before they engage with others, whether it's in the private sector or whatever. So all civic functions in Malmo will meet these new food standards, putting their own house in order and leading by example. All the policies are joined up: social justice, ecology, economy, children's health as well. Malmo, as far as I can tell, and Sweden generally, are not obsessed in the way that Brits are obsessed. Whenever we did our work on school food, people said, what's the evidence that that good food is having a dividend for kids? Where's the evidence for that? Of course, we always said the science is lagging behind common sense. The Swedes don't obsess about this. Good food is obviously better for children in terms of their attitudes, behavior, their capacity for learning, and longer term, of course, their health as citizens. But you can't measure those health gains in the short term, and we shouldn't be compelled to try. We shouldn't play that game, you know? Good food is good for children and it's good for patients. But we can come back to that evidence-based argument a moment, because we can't just dismiss it. But the Swedes don't seem to obsess about it. Moving now to Bristol, I've got to declare an interest here that I'm not a neutral observer in Bristol. Three years ago, Bristol formed what I think was the first food policy council in the United Kingdom, the first city to organise it, a food policy council bringing together the city council and the food and public health communities of civil society, creating the first food policy council in Britain. The council leader asked me to chair that food policy council, and I'm still doing it 3 years on, though I've lost a few friends in Cardiff that couldn't quite go there with me, thinking I was going over the border and chairing a rival food policy council. But I've learned a lot from Bristol, because Bristol is one of the most dynamic civil societies that I know, certainly in England. I would say Bristol and Brighton. And Brighton, where I lived for 15 years, I think has got a stronger and better food partnership than Bristol, though Bristol doesn't like me saying that. And we can talk about that later. It's a more resilient system in Brighton because it can wash its face and it can pay its way, whereas still in Bristol, it's a labour of love by and large. Everyone is devoting their labour free. The council is giving us officers. The NHS is lending us officers. And we're all giving our time for free. It's partly a smoke and mirrors exercise, but it's been quite successful, I would say. But Brighton is a superior model, and we can talk about that later. But in terms of Bristol, one of the most important things that Bristol did, I think, and it's something that we're going to talk about at the food conference, the Sustainable Glasgow conference tomorrow, because I think it has big lessons, this, for Glasgow. One of the most important things Bristol did was to produce an urban food audit to say, how on earth does this city feed itself? Where does the food come from? How far does it travel? To what extent do we live with food poverty in the city? How come some neighborhoods are living cheek by jowl next door to each other? Some are food secure, some are food insecure. In other words, it painted a new picture of a city through the prism of its food system. This had a big effect on the system. It generated debates at all levels of society, not just middle-class foodies. The BBC covered it, the local press covered it, town halls had meetings about it. Are we living in a food desert? If so, why? So it triggered a whole series of new debates by making food visible in the city. And this was an amazing report written by a food researcher called Joy Carey, originally from the Soil Association and now a local food expert based in Bristol. But again, you can see from the subtitles and from this diagram, it's a bit like New York. And we've learned something from New York. Why? Because the Bristol food plan, the good food plan, as we call it, is all about thinking about food system planning, not about this or that project, but thinking of the food system as a whole. And as you may know, Bristol has been the first British city to win the European Green Capital Award. Next year, Bristol becomes the first city to use that accolade, and it's going to use it to fly the flag for sustainable urban food. Rome influenced us a lot in terms of thinking about food. When we did our school food report, our school food book rather, which we produced in the end on school food reform around the world and published it in 2008, one of the best school food systems we saw anywhere in the world was Rome. It was a fantastic food system. And the mayor of Rome invited us to come and eat a school dinner with him in a school in Rome, which we did. And I have to say, I was shocked because on the menu that day was Welsh lamb. He said it was a pure coincidence, but it was a marvelous meal. And sometime afterwards, we funded a delegation of school caterers from Wales to go out to Italy. And we funded the leaders of the school dinners ladies in Wales. And we did a deal with her. We said, we'll fund you to go out, but you've got to come in and tell our students what you learned. She went out for a week, had a good time, learned a lot, and the students said, what's the main thing you learned from Italy? And she said, without even thinking about it, no choice. There's no choice in the menu. She said, if my ladies could do a school food system where I didn't have to replicate the high street and get involved in lots of choice, aka waste, and serve a meal, a three-course meal, soup, meat and veg, fruit. This is what they were serving in Rome. Then that's the most important thing I learned. She said, they weren't troubled by food, by choice. An interesting point, because at that time, of course, choice was being lauded as the big deal for British consumers. Before I leave Rome, can I just say this system is collapsing, because since 2009, a right-wing mayor has been elected into Rome, and he's unraveling the system rapidly, and Rome is going downhill fast. Again, illustrating a point I mentioned in connection with Amsterdam, that one has to sustain sustainability by building a political coalition in politics, but also in civil societies, to sustain the gains, the little victories that we've made. Okay, Now I want to come to New York, and then I want to come home to try to raise some issues, hopefully that we can discuss. New York is important for many, many reasons, it seems to me. But one of the most important reasons of all is because I don't know another city that has treated its public health mandate so seriously across a series of different mayors. New York has pioneered public health at the urban level in the United States. New York is to public health what California is to environmental regulation. They are pioneers in their fields in terms of setting new benchmarks for other cities or other states to follow. And here we have New York. School food, food on the streets, farmers markets, but it's the public health message that I want to show you and share with you. And then I want to look at the reaction from the big food companies to what cities can expect if they treat their public health mandate seriously. New York developed some of the most colorful and some of the most compelling adverts for healthy food and against unhealthy food and drink, particularly sugar. As we all probably know, we're living in an era right now where sugar is about to become the new tobacco. And on the next 5 years, we'll see a major battle around sugar. And we can talk about that in a moment. But it's very difficult to avoid added sugar, free sugars, as they say in nutritional circles. Very difficult to avoid it, particularly in the United States. In the United States, 80% of all food, total food, has added sugar. 80%. So it's not easy to avoid the environment of added sugar in an American style diet, which, as you know, is sweeping the world. So New York City is trying to do something about this through these adverts on sugar, calories, on trans fats, calorie posting on menus, you name it. New York was the first city ever to try it. But this is what happened. This is one of the most important adverts in the debate about healthy food. Mayor Bloomberg, who's no longer mayor of New York, as you know, he was defeated last year, or he ended his term last year. Mayor Bloomberg wasn't a particularly radical mayor, but he did treat his public health mandate seriously, and he really did go for sugared drinks. And there's a very famous case last year called the soda cap, where he tried to cap 16-ounce soda drinks. Not to ban them, just to reduce the fact that kids could go into a movie house, into a cinema, with a ginormous soda drink and a ginormous bag of popcorn. And he tried to put a cap on it. And to cut a long story short, this cap was deemed illegal by the Supreme Court in New York State. For many reasons for that. It was a legalistic definition in the end, but the American Brewers Association really pulled out all the stops. They invested a small fortune in it, and I have to say, in the popular vote, the poorest boroughs had the highest vote against Bloomberg's soda cap. The poorest boroughs voted against. Bloomberg himself was defeated on it by a court judge. But he was defeated because of the way he tried to introduce it through the back door and tried to impose it on a city rather than try to engage the hearts and minds of a city in terms of thinking about healthy food and drinks. The last point I want to make about this advert, by the way, a full page advert in the New York Times, this advert, and it was paid for by the Center for Consumer Freedom, which is a front, a lobbying front for big food, the food and drink companies. And by the way, the Center for Consumer Freedom are the very same people that 10 years ago were trying to persuade us that tobacco was actually good for us. So we need to realize these links between big tobacco and sugared beverages. So that's a lesson in terms of what big food will do about healthy food messages from cities. So bringing this talk to an end now to raise some issues. Personally, I think when we look around the world, I think we can say that There's a new social movement emerging in cities today, and it's emerging in and around food. There's very different aspects, of course. Some people are into fair trade, some people into local food, others are into organic, others are into good food, or however that's defined. But when you bring all this stuff together, it seems to me that this is one of the fastest growing urban movements in the world today. And civil society groups are beginning to change their political tactics. They used to just fight government in terms of contesting a government's regulations or policies. And now they're forming partnerships with governments to try to design healthier food policies with governments. I'm involved with two of these groups and have been for a number of years. Sustain is a group for good food and farming, and it's done, I think, some excellent work on good food, not just for London, but good food for children throughout the country. And then there's the Soil Association, of course, with its Good Food for All. The Soil Association Food for Life programme, which in many ways is the gold standard of school food reform in the United Kingdom today. Both of these are excellent groups, but both of these groups are under pressure because of the age of austerity. It's cutting back local authority grants, and local authorities can't afford to support these ventures in civil society, which is creating a big crisis, I think, for all progressive politics in Britain today. But let me end with these more troubling, well, not more troubling, equally troubling questions. First of all, we are seeing these new forms of governance emerging. Food policy councils. Bristol was the first to develop one in a formal sense, calling itself the Bristol Food Policy Council. But others were earlier into the urban food policy realm. Brighton, London, and Manchester, for example. If I can just mention Brighton and why I think it's superior to the Bristol model. Brighton has a food partnership, local council, National Health, what used to be called in England, the primary care trusts. By the way, when the history of the local food movement comes to be written in the UK, and particularly in England, the primary care trusts, now abolished, will be the unsung heroes of the local food movement because they funded it. It was the resources from public health teams in the NHS that funded the healthy local food movement, in my view, and they need credit for that. But in Brighton's food partnership basically said to the primary care trust, primary care trusts, as you know, have now been merged with local government in England, creating, I think, a potential route for a really joined up, sustainable food policy if local councils can be persuaded to treat public health seriously and not to raid the budget of public health, which is part of the debate, as you know, in England right now. But why Brighton, in my view, is superior to Bristol, and I've argued this in Bristol's Food Policy Council, is because they've built a trading arm which has now generated £1 million a year turnover, and it affords a wage staff of 18 urban food officers who are funded full-time jobs and £1 million trading from a trading arm which it's built up by delivering healthy food programmes into the very poorest communities in Brighton, communities which the public health establishment, laudable, well-meaning as it is, just couldn't get into. It couldn't deliver in these very poor working class communities, whereas this social enterprise can, because it's based there. And out of that marriage of convenience, if you will, the Brighton Food Partnership offering to deliver healthy food programs in the very poorest communities, they have built a trading arm. And this is what we're now considering in Bristol in more difficult times, as you can imagine, because now we're doing it in the age of austerity, when Brighton were doing it, I don't say in an age of plenty, but before the age of austerity kicked in. So that's why Brighton, in my view, has a more resilient model of how to develop an urban food partnership than Bristol or any other city that I'm aware of. So food partnerships are developing. I hope we'll see one in Glasgow to build on the progress that you've already made in the city in recent years. But let me end by talking about the Sustainable Food Cities Network. This has now been launched, and we are now recruiting new cities into this network. The Sustainable Food Cities Network does three things, it seems to me. Number one, it helps cities to learn good practice without having to make all the mistakes themselves. So they learn faster by being part of a network of peer-to-peer learning. Secondly, they raise the profile of cities as proper kosher actors in the food policy debates in the UK. And then thirdly, they strengthen the voice of cities in food policy debates. This is very, very important, it seems to me, particularly in the United Kingdom at this point in time, because we are seeing a situation which, in my view, is nothing short of a scandal in terms of Whitehall food and health policy, where large industrial food companies are effectively writing health policy. The responsibility deals, as they're called, voluntaristic arrangements where companies offer voluntary targets to meet certain levels of sugar or calories are no substitute for a robust health strategy. The real innovative, robust thinking in public health in the UK today, in my view, is coming from Scotland, is coming from Wales, and is coming from leading urban food pioneers like Bristol, like Brighton, like Manchester, and others. And this is why urban food policy is so important, because it shows what a country can achieve, can be scaled up to a UK level by showing people, by giving people a taste of tomorrow, today, by showing what is possible at a local level. Thank you very much. Thanks, Jim.